Hey everyone, welcome to a new episode of Vodka O'Clock Podcast. I'm your host, Amber Love, from amberunmasked.com. You can sponsor my work and the show at patreon.com/amberunmasked, which gives you early access to the weekly cat stories about Gus and Ollie's adventures and the crazy stuff we find here in New Jersey. A lot of it has to do with cryptids and mysteries and different crimes and the chipmunk mafia and fun stuff like that. So joining me today is TJ Kirsch, who is I've known on the internet for quite some time. And we are finally getting the chance to talk about his comics and his background, and in particular, a new comic that he has made about Willie Nelson. So, TJ, welcome, welcome, welcome. I'm so glad that you're here.
Thank you very much for having me.
So I know that you went to Cubert's down here in New Jersey, mm-hmm. but you are stationed all the way up in Albany.
Correct.
And beautiful this time of year, of course.
Yes.
You've got this wonderful resume of being a writer, an artist, and a literary agent.
Yes.
So since I don't get to talk to agents very often, I did want to ask a little bit about that, like how you came into this role of being an agent, and you know where people can, you know, find you or pitch to you or whatever your process is, if you're open for things or not open right now.
Mm-hmm. Sure. Yeah. I mean, it's something that I sort of fell into accidentally at the end of last year. You know, I had been toiling away for 15 plus years as a comic book artist and writer, and financially it wasn't really paying off as much as I would have liked, of course. And so I was looking for something else to do that activated another part of my brain, and something that I could still utilize a lot of the contacts and connections and experience that I had while still being in that world with one foot in sort of the traditional book publishing world. And I had been doing this in some form for a while before that, in a sense, just kind of facilitating friendships between publishers that I had worked with and have had experience with friends of mine who were looking for projects, sort of matchmaking in that sense, just here and there, somewhat unsuccessfully, mind you, but I enjoyed the making of the connections and sort of mentoring people and facilitating their own books and helping them out in whatever way I can, just with my own experience. And at the end of last year, an opportunity kind of presented itself with a friend of mine, and he was looking for a publisher for his book. And so I said, maybe I can just be your agent and I can do this. And thinking, you know, how hard can it be? and it's very hard.
I was going to say there's like things to, all that legal stuff to read and review. And
yeah. But most of it is reading people's submissions and developing relationships with editors and publishers. And, that aspect of it, I really enjoy. And, just being a part of people's creative process and kind of taking care of that end of their work while still mentoring them in a sense with the creative stuff as well. So it's interesting and it's fulfilling, and but it's different than the work I had been doing.
And is your focus just on comics? I know it's like, you know, it's not as common for comic creators to have agents, but it's, you know, every once in a while you hear of it, or what, you know, or are you delving into other things?
Well, initially my focus was to just focus on graphic novels and target those graphic novel publishers and those, the graphic novel imprints of the larger publishers in New York and elsewhere. But as time went on, as I talked to more and more editors, I kind of learned that I should probably cast a wider net if I wanted to make any kind of mark as an agent. Because it's tough to find great projects that need agents and that are also ready to be published. You'd think there'd be more, but you know, it's tough to find them and tough to find clients in a consistent way and in one spot or another.
Yeah, like you said, with stuff that's ready to be published, and every agent that I've seen on Twitter talks about that, you know, the time to look for an agent nowadays, because it's different, is when you have stuff as finished as and polished as possible.
Right.
So how does that work with something like, you know, like a picture book or something that's, you know, that's a bigger project? Do you still have to wait for, I mean, does somebody know exactly what measurements and resolutions and all that stuff?
Well, that kind of stuff comes. Are? Yeah, that kind of stuff comes later.
Okay.
The picture book author clients that I have currently are all specifically writers. So they are shopping around picture book text submissions only.
Okay.
And I'm definitely open to writer artists, because then you can tell, you know, right off the bat whether their work is professional or not. But with text submissions, you have to go in and read them, obviously. And but editors also like to acquire those text manuscripts and then match them to an appropriate artist. Oftentimes, artists that they've already worked with or they have a relationship with. That way they can control the entire production process from the get-go. And it can be art directed through their department and everything like that. So it's a kind of a controlled process in that sense. But but the clients that I have currently are all text-based. And it's just their manuscripts that I acquired and signed, and that their scripts just kind of spoke to me, and I thought they were really, really good, so that's why I signed them. And from there, I have to contact the editors and submit to them and things like that.
Yeah, this is one of the reasons that I would love an agent, because that sounds like the much harder part than the writing and editing. I mean, because trust me, I know revisions are so necessary and everything, but it's the shopping around and the wait, you know, all the rejection. It's like, oh,
yeah, it's a lot of waiting.
Painful. It's yeah, a lot of waiting, and it's painful. Has stuff, I didn't get to talk to you about this previously, has stuff like Kickstarter made any kind of impact for agents in the sense where they could say, look, this person already has a certain amount of fan base, or there's already funding. So like, you know, we could already pay for the artist from fans. Does that happen through this type of stuff that you work on? Because obviously I back Kickstarters as whenever I can, especially, you know, for comics. Mm-hmm. And they range anywhere from people looking for, you know, $2,000 all the way up to people looking for $50,000.
Right.
So, it's very, very broad in how people can make these books come to life. So does that have any impact on agent perspectives?
I would say from an editor's perspective, anything that indicates that this person has fans or a following, it can never hurt in that sense. So if they've previously raised a bunch of money with a bunch of fans, an agent will definitely take notice and put that in the back of their minds. But yeah, I'm not sure. It's just, it's always a case by case basis. And if the work is good and they have a strong fan base, that's a winning combination, obviously.
Yeah. I just know that with how most people are struggling these days in the creative industries, that it's, you know, I see people who have very successful traditional book series. They're, you know, they have agent representation. They, you know, they might have a 3-book deal, but they also have Patreons to keep going every month. It's, you know,
it's an interesting mix of things going on at the moment.
Yeah.
I can think of a few people that, that have Patreons and pretty big book deals going on at the same moment. And it's kind of like, I just always think of James Kochalka, you know, in the late 90s and the early 2000s, he would have a book at Top Shelf and then have a book at High Water Books and then a book at, you know, somewhere else, just because he was afraid of any one publisher just going under at any one moment, because it was, you know, it's such a small amount of money that's changing hands with a small press, you know what I mean? So it's just having your income from several different kinds of places at the same time.
It's so funny that you bring him up though, because I think he's got books out with IDW right now.
Yeah, and he's got a new Scholastic series coming out pretty soon.
Scholastic sounds nice. That sounds, you know.
Oh, sounds, yeah,
like a good deal.
I'm sure it is.
So let's see. Okay, so that takes you into the world of being a literary agent. But as you said, that came after you know, you've already had an established career as a writer and an artist. And let's jump into the Wayback Machine and talk about little TJ and how your creative aspirations were supported, if they were supported. What it was like in school, or because I'm always curious to know if people had the kind of like teachers or parents that were supportive, or if they were just like, you know, you're going to need a real career, right? Like, you know, you're going to need to like have something else on the.
It's funny, you know, I think back to back then, and you know, I was always the kid that could draw in elementary school, and I remember distinctly, you know, drawing pictures of whatever, the Simpsons or Mickey Mouse, and classmates would kind of crowd around in like a half circle around my desk as I was drawing. And I'd be like, that's nice that you want to see me draw, but can I be alone? But yeah, I mean, teachers were always supportive, and more than once, more than a few times, you know, there'd be a school project or something, and everybody wanted to be my partner because, you know, if there was any kind of art aspect to the project, I could nail that while they can just, you know, go outside and play or whatever.
Oh, you had a good science fair board, right?
Sure. Oh, of course. Yeah.
Now, you were you a follow the rules kid, or were you like drawing on the desk?
No. I was always a quiet, very appropriate kid. Very kept to myself, and the drawing was just kind of my own thing. It was my own little world that I could retreat to.
So I've said plenty of times that a lot of times my love for comics really was more in cartoons. I loved the Super Friends and Spider-Man and His Amazing Friends and all the Hanna-Barbera stuff.
Sure.
And Herculoids and those wonderful cheesy things. So what kind of influences did you have? Because, the funny papers, I don't even know if they still print funny pages anymore. I know they online.
It's getting smaller and smaller. I mean,
it's got to be hard to have a syndicated strip.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
I think the Spider-Man one like just ended after 50 years or something.
Oh, really? I didn't even know that was still running.
I think it was running up until recently.
Yeah. Yeah, I was on the board of my local paper's comic page. They had like a comics panel of comics experts, and I made it into that board, which was pretty cool. We got to go to the paper in the big conference room and feel important and have our input about what comics they should either cut or bring on board.
Wow.
And it was so cool. So I think my big accomplishment was getting Keith Knight's strip in the Times Union. And I got to tell him that in person when I saw him at SPX, and he thanked me, and that was pretty cool.
Oh, wow.
But yeah, that was pretty cool. But yeah, as a kid, I loved comic strips. I loved, Garfield and Peanuts. And later on, it was Zits. But yeah, I liked the comic strips. I liked Disney Channel was like a whole new thing when I was growing up. And they didn't have a lot of content to begin with, so they would just rerun, all the cartoons from the 40s and 50s and 60s, just these shorts that would just like play on a loop all day. And I think that kind of like programmed my brain for the rest of my life to like Disney cartoons. So I liked that. And my older brother would bring DC Comics around. So he would always have Flash and Superman and Batman. This is like late 80s, early 90s. And so that was a big influence on me. And I could still identify any kind of late 80s, early 90s DC Comics artist, within a second. And
as long as that's they're allowed to do that. I think, when we start talking about this Willie Nelson book of yours, when artists are allowed to have their own style as opposed to certain publishers that end up redoing a lot of the art in some way. And I don't even know if the people who go through that process get credit.
Uh-huh.
They buy these pages of art, but then they want all of their books to look a certain way. Or they just come up at a publishing house where everybody draws exactly the same.
Right. Or they hire the people that are influenced by the people that they hired or 15 years earlier.
Yes. So, everybody draws the same one body shape for, what they consider a female body and one masculine body. And
sure. It's a shorthand.
You change the clothes a little bit, the color of the clothes. That's just it. If it wasn't in color, then you wouldn't even be able to tell the characters apart.
Right. Yeah.
But so the pages that you've created with your friends that we'll talk about is so different. So yeah, back in you know, at least even now you can see certain publishing houses like DC and Marvel, you know, you can identify artists right away.
Yeah.
You know, I love that too. When I can look at somebody makes, I don't know, a meme or whatever, and I'll just be like, ah, oh, that's a Katie Cook. Right. I'm like, I know that. But it's like going to a museum and you can say, that's the Monet. That's, of you course. Know, yeah. That's the Degas.
Mm-hmm.
So after, you know, elementary school and high school and all this, then how did you continue on? Did you decide that art was definitely the way to go?
Yeah.
You jumped in.
I mean, I was totally into it, into drawing and all throughout elementary school and middle school. And but the end of middle school and into high school, I kind of gave up drawing for a while, and I got really into playing in a band. And I was a drummer in a band for all 4 years of high school, and taking that super seriously. And the only real drawing that I did during high school was, you know, an art class, and you know, here and there. I didn't really take it too seriously. But when high school kind of came to an end and I had to make a decision about what I was going to do next, I always knew in the back of my mind that I was going to go to art school, and that was kind of my direction, my destiny. So I was researching art schools, and I wanted to go somewhere in the South where it was warm, because after, you know, all the Northeast winters I've been through, I just wanted some warm weather. That's all I wanted. So I was flipping through a lot of, you know, college course catalogs and whatnot. And I saw, SCAD, Savannah College of Art and Design. And I liked what they had to offer as far as their school and their environment and the city. And it just looked gorgeous and like paradise. So that was where I was going to go. And I got in after applying there and a couple other schools. And I remember having to pick my major online, like a little bit before school started, before the school semester started. And so just on a whim, I chose sequential art because there was a sequential art major, a comic art major. And they were pretty much the only game in town at that point as far as studying comics at a university. So it just kind of happened. And I hadn't really been reading comics too much since I was younger, but I realized at that exact moment that all my favorite artists were comic book artists, and it just happened that way. And I ended up there and studying how to make comics and drawing comics and writing comics. And they had a great library of insanely influential alternative comics that pretty much shaped my taste in comics for years to come and still does. Like just Chester Brown and Dan Clowes and Seth and and those guys. And it just, from there I was just obsessed with comics and all that went into it. And so that 20 years ago, that kind of set me on a path, which I'm still on right now, and in the comics world. And my comics education has never stopped, I think.
Now, when they, in an art school like that, I imagine you probably had to take art history, which I took in a regular college.
Yeah.
Or art, you know, art appreciation type stuff. Mm-hmm. So with a comics major, was there a, like, were there history classes that didn't involve, you know, drawing and just involved studying?
Yeah. I mean, I was only there for a year, so I didn't have too many courses that were intensely comics focused. I think I had one studio class that was like, you know, intro to sequential art one, and the rest of the courses were foundational art courses that everybody has to take that goes to the art school. So it was drawing and design and color. And I was bad at all of that before I went there. And then I never really paid attention to color theory or art history or anything before that that school year. So it was really a good refresher. And I learned a lot of the basics of drawing that I kind of never really formally studied, and because I was just kind of a lazy kid, and drawing was just kind of my outlet. I didn't really formally study it in any serious way. So that year was really my foundational year, learning how to hone whatever raw ability that I had. And it was really helpful. And by the time I did get to those courses, the comics courses later in that school year, I was totally on board. And on my own, in my own downtime there, I was checking out every single book in that library and just studying them with a magnifying glass. And, you know, how does Dan Clowes letter? How does Chris Ware color? All of those things. And so that was really helpful as well, to deconstruct that and just immerse myself in comics.
You know, like thinking about Chris Ware and like how completely different their pages can look. Like they can have, you know, like 30 itty bitty tiny panels.
Yeah.
You know, as opposed to like, you know, five big chunky panels or something like that. Mm-hmm. You know, it's just really wild, and you see the character going through, and you know, like through whatever it is. It's a different reading experience altogether.
Definitely, yeah.
You know, and it's like, hey, but it's still comics, you know.
yeah. I was learning, you know, how to put together comics, and here are people who learn the rules of comics and they take it as far as they can in one direction, really being kind of a formalist like Chris Ware or like Matt Madden. Those people are just kind of playing with the form in an academic type way, you know, boiling things down to comic iconography and, you know, making them almost symbols. You know, you abstract something so much that it's barely even a drawing. It's like a,
right.
You know, it's like a letter, a character, you know, a character of a letter, you know what I mean?
Right.
So yeah, that was great to see where you could take comics in a formal way and in an abstract way. And but yeah, that was just my time to learn on my own, and basically supplemented by whatever course I was taking at the time. But I had some great teachers.
I've heard great things about SCAD. I mean,
yeah.
I've always heard great things about them. And then you ended up, even after a year there, then you did 3 whole years at Qbert's, which is no easy task.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
you know, it's 3 very difficult years.
Yes, it was very difficult. After that year at SCAD, I took a year off. I tried a liberal arts college, the College of St. Rose here in Albany, and I just didn't like it. It was like going back to high school after being at art school for a year and then going back to a liberal arts school. It was like shock to the system. It was like culture shock in reverse. You know what I mean? Art school was like a this freak show party. Like, it was, you know, the most different, odd people from every school in the country coming to a school. And, you know, every art nerd in every high school, and they end up in one place, and that's what art school is. And, but going back to a liberal arts school just to try that and studying studio art was just, oof, it was not fun. And so I quit there, and Kubert School was my kind of, Hail Mary. Like, I got to do something. I got to study something at some school, or else I'm just going to have to go to work. So, and I knew about Kubert from, you know, when they had the ads in DC Comics in the 80s and 90s. Yep. And, you know, I'm like, Bart Sears went there. And I mean, he's an amazing artist. So, and you kind of learn over the years by, you know, reading Wizard magazine or whatever, that that the Kubert School is incredibly difficult. And it's like a boot camp for artists.
It is.
And
yeah.
So I was, but I knew that I kind of needed a push and a kick in the ass, just because I was lazy, and, you know, if I could get away with doing the bare minimum, and then I would do it. But I know you can't get away with that stuff at a place like Kubert School, when you have to really put in the work.
Like you said, the kicking in the ass.
Yes.
Like
they, you know, your ass has to be in the chair.
Yeah. You exactly. And, you know, some people don't. I mean, 3 years, it feels like a long time when you're there, you know, when you're going through it. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, before you know it, it's like, okay, now what?
Yeah, now what do I do?
Now what do I do?
But I loved it. And I mean, I have so many lifelong friends that I made there. And it's like, I was telling someone the other day, it's like the equivalent of being in a wartime foxhole. It really is like boot camp. And you're just in a room at a drawing table. You're like shackled to this drawing table, not literally, but, you know, hours and hours a day. And then you say goodbye to your friends, and then you go home, and you got to do 3 or 4 more hours of work for the next day's classes, assignments that you have to turn in. And, so it's just a lot of your ass in the chair drawing, and you can only get better if you do that. Mm-hmm. So that's why so many talented people come out of that school having graduated, is because they've put in the time. And if they're halfway decent when they get there, they're ready to go when they're done.
Yeah, absolutely. And they also have, you know, they'll have somebody from DC, I think, usually come in and do like portfolio reviews once a year or stuff like mm-hmm. that. So they, you know,
I remember
they have great contacts as well, and you have opportunities.
They do.
You know, plus the local conventions, when we could have them, usually there would be a Kubert School booth, mm-hmm. which was, you know, was great, because then the students could go to the show for, you know, for free or whatever, or at least at a discount, I would assume, and, you know, work some time at the booth.
Yeah. Plus, I mean, it's a short train ride to New York City, and, you know, that's like the whole world opens up to you if you can just get on a train and go to New York for a couple hours. And so that was a pretty attractive aspect of the Kubert School too.
And so you, immediately, like, you knew that creator owned and making your own stories was more of a draw for you than the idea of, you know, writing or drawing Spider-Man or something. Like, how, you know?
Well, it was kind of a mix. I mean, that year off before Kubert School, I really, I kind of hunkered down, and tried to make my own thing. And I was starting to make mini comics and getting them printed at Kinko's and things like that, mm-hmm. which is a really good education in and of itself, seeing how your work would be printed and adjusting it and seeing what works, seeing what doesn't work, and just polishing your storytelling, making actual comics. So I was doing that while I was a parking lot guy at an independent movie theater here in Albany, which was the greatest gig because I could just sit and just watch the parking lot for a few seconds and then go back to making comics. and I got free popcorn, free soda, and free movies when I wasn't working. So
yeah. It's a lot like my receptionist jobs. I was like, yeah. I'm just here writing my novel, occasionally answering the phone and hitting transfer, you know?
Right. Like, yeah. So by the time I went to Kubert School, I was really adamant about making my own comics and writing my own stuff. But when I got there, you know, I started looking at it as a profession, and I would have taken whatever work came my way. And so I was pretty open-minded about everything, but I still had my favorites. I still had, you know, Chester Brown and Dan Clowes books that I would pour over every few days and then go to school the next day. And my classmates at Kubert would be passing around, you know, the latest Batman issue or what have you. And so I was studying kind of all aspects of every type of comic, and it was great.
Yeah, and the school itself, when you walk through those halls, and it's mm-hmm. like just the most magnificent, like, gallery basically of going through, you know, you see the different pages that people mm-hmm. have worked on, or they have big murals and stuff.
Yeah, just to see it's Joe Kubert's artwork up close.
Yeah.
That's just worth going and visiting a school by itself. I mean, it's yeah. His work is pretty incredible to look at up close.
So when you started thinking about storytelling and working on your own stuff, and this is something that obviously comics has an interesting breakdown of, is sometimes you're the writer, sometimes you're the artist, sometimes you're the color artist, sometimes you're the letterer, and
yeah.
you can do all of those things. So, you know, did you go through any collaborations prior to the Willie Nelson book?
Oh yeah, definitely.
Okay.
Right after I graduated, I got hired as an art intern at Archie because I'd sent them an art submission and a cover letter, and I got a call from them that were looking for art interns, and I went down there and got interviewed, and they ended up hiring me for that. So for the summer, I was helping everybody out that needed any kind of art help on the, you know, on the art boards or just doing computer coloring or production stuff, which was really fun. And I got to know a lot of people there. And I guess I made enough of an impression that they hired me in the fall as a full-time production artist for the Digest department when someone left, and they called me up and asked me to come down. So I worked there for about 8 or 9 months, I think. And so that was pretty cool. And but as far as collaboration after that, I illustrate a lot of writers' scripts, and so I had some experience with collaboration. And at Kubert, there's always assignments where somebody would color your stuff or ink your stuff, or you're inking somebody else. just to kind of get used to that process, if that's the way you want to go in your career. So I always liked collaborating with people in any form.
When you did Pride of a Decent Man, was that all you, including the lettering and stuff?
Yeah, that was all me.
That was all you. Okay.
That was all me. I think the first few pages I had some help with coloring. But then a friend of mine, he taught me like some shortcuts for coloring in Manga Studio. And then I just kind of burned through coloring pretty fast and was able to do everything myself. And but yeah, that was my sort of singular vision. And that was my one solo graphic novel that I've done so far. And that's kind of the thing that I had been working towards since I started studying comics like 20 years ago.
Well, you worked on that for a really, you know, decent amount of time. Mm-hmm. I remember the inks in particular. Was that all digital?
Yeah, everything was digital. I've been working all digital since about 2008. I did an Oni Press book called Uncle Slam Fights Back. It was supposed to be kind of an election cycle relevant thing. There was like a robot John McCain and Uncle Slam was Andy Parks' character, and he was kind of the elevator pitch for that book was just kind of Captain America if he had been brainwashed by Fox News, which in 2008 sounds quaint, but if you can imagine that happening this year, it would be a different book.
Exactly. But, the Mueller Report book is out from IDW, by the way.
Right.
So,
yeah. But yeah, since then I was digital just because I was, I had a short deadline for that and I needed to do it quicker than I had been doing work. And I had a full-time job at the time. So I convinced my boss to let me go part-time temporarily so I could go home and like work on that and then come back the next day and do the same thing until I had the book done.
And then, have a baby.
Well, that came much later, but yeah, then that book came out and there was like, a month between it coming out and election day. So there wasn't much time to promote it. And after election day, it was kind of irrelevant. So it kind of disappeared into the ether.
Oh my goodness. Yeah. Now it's so funny because, you know, comics have always been political. There's always been political content, even if just thinking about from like our generation, our lifetimes, you know, you think about the X-Men, and plenty of comics have had political storylines, and people seem to be all up in arms now, like, oh, you're forcing your feminism in my comic and blah blah blah. It's like, dude, have you picked up a book? Like, I mean,
yeah, did you ever read Wonder Woman in the 40s, or did you ever read
Mary Worth, you know, was a comic strip, you know?
Do you remember that cover where Captain America was punching the Nazi or punching Hitler?
Yeah, exactly. It's like, you know, come on, really? Yeah, it's absurd when people get like that.
Yeah.
So you got to work when you did Pride of a Decent Man. That was with NBM Publishing, and they're also the ones that are making these cool biographies. Mm-hmm. And this is where we come into this Willie Nelson book. Because I you know, just grazed through their catalog section, and they have like Bob Marley and Monet and Einstein. They have all these very diverse biographies. And so did they approach you, or did you pitch them? How did it come about?
Well, I pitched them. Being that I worked with them on Pride of the Decent Man, I wanted to work with them again. And I knew that they were doing books like that, and I knew they did an Elvis book and a Beatles book and Bob Marley, and but they hadn't yet really done something country music centric. And I had been getting into the old time country music and like Hank Williams and I'm drawing a blank now, of course, but but all of Willie Nelson's influences were playing on this Sirius XM channel of his called Willie's Roadhouse. And I started listening to this just kind of accidentally one day. And I really got into it. And coincidentally, it's those musicians, those artists and singers, they were what both of my grandfathers were into. You know, my grandfather would always sing Roger Miller songs under his breath, whistling into a room. And my other grandfather would be reciting Johnny Cash songs. And mm-hmm. So all of these people, it feels like kind of coming home, and it's comforting to hear that stuff just because I heard it growing up without even really knowing it, just it playing in the background while I was a kid. And so I got into it, and I, you know, researched the origins of it and really got into it. And Willie Nelson would come up a lot, and I knew he was just super popular all over the world, and he has had such a career. And but I mean, I was just a casual fan, like anybody else. I knew On the Road Again. I knew that.
Yeah, you know, the greatest hits.
And, yeah, Always on My Mind. And, you know, I knew for some reason that he wrote Crazy by Patsy Cline. I learned that
years ago. I didn't know that until I read your book. I was like, mm-hmm. Holy cow, this whole time. Yeah.
Yep. And I think I just thought that was really natural to pick him because, I mean, one, he looks so distinctive. He would be fun to draw.
Exactly.
But he's just so popular, and he's just one of those, pop culture figures that everybody likes and nobody has a bad thing to say about. He's an activist. He stands up for the right things. He's got a positive attitude. I mean, what's not to like? So, I mean, I pitched that as a book to Terry Nantier at NBM, and right away he just said, yeah, go do it. Go ahead. That sounds great.
Wow.
Because, I mean, all the other biographies, I think, were translated from European writers and artists, like the Beatles and Elvis, which is strange because they're, American and English artists. But their biographies are being done in Europe just because their market over there is so diverse that something like that can survive over there. And I'm glad that people like Terry are bringing them to our shores and diversifying our comic market and bringing in different genres and sort of the literary genres and just elevating what comics can be. I'm thankful that he's doing that. And, but I think he grew up for years when he was younger in France. And, that was a big part of his, creating his mission as a publisher was seeing the market over there and wondering why that we don't look at comics as an art form like the rest of the world does.
Exactly. Yeah. Why it's they have respect for it over.
Yeah. Yeah. More than anything else, it's just respect and they treat artists like real artists and not like here where people are, think it's just this throwaway kind of lowbrow art,
Right. And this, so the, the people that you got to work with on the Willie Nelson book, some of them are American and some of them are not. So I know you got to also bring on people that you knew from Q-Berts as well. Mm-hmm. So I definitely want to give them their props if we can get through their names.
Yes.
Koshkun Kuzgun is the first one. And I mean, magnificent, realistic looking painting. And it's also, you know, and it's funny, we were talking about, you know, how distinctive Willie Nelson is, you know, his early days when he wore a suit and, you know, in his youth, before the braids, like I always knew him with the braids. You know, it's like, I wouldn't have recognized him. So it was great seeing that. And then chapter two is very different style, Jeremy Massey. And then we go to Håvard Johansson, Jesse Lonergan, Jason Pittman, JT Yost, and then you rounded out with the end there, TJ Kirsch. But you also have your friend Adam. So definitely want to give a shout out to Adam Walmsley.
Adam Walmsley.
Beautiful portraits.
Yes, he's so great with likenesses, and everybody has great things to say about his chapter illustrations. And he did the first and last sequential pages of the book, and the art director at NBM saw fit to use his artwork for the end papers of the hardcover book as well. So it's Adam was pretty surprised to see his artwork blown up, and he's like, I didn't even know they were going to do that. That's pretty cool.
It's gorgeous.
Yeah.
So it's staying all black and white. I mean, at least the proof I read is all black and white, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Everything's black and white. I just knew it was going to take, you know, much longer to do a color book, and keeping it black and white is just another way to unify all the artwork. Because every chapter is a different artist. That's just one of the ways that I thought we could unify the book as a whole. It's somewhat of a throwback doing black and white these days, but when it's done well, it looks really great, I think.
Oh yeah. It's, you know, it's a monochrome, you know, palette, but it's, there's so much like variation in the grayscale. And like I said, once you get to chapter two, like the inking style is totally different.
Right.
So it's, yeah, you can tell you're reading the same book. But there is this breath, you know, this vibrancy that comes through of like, oh, this is how this person, you know, sees them.
And yeah,
it's really cool. But I did want to get into how you steered the whole project, which I find fascinating because, you also had to do, you did all the lettering. So as opposed to you taking on all of the tasks, you still had to manage the project yourself.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, yeah, that's just another one of the ways that I wanted to unify the art as a whole, was to do the lettering myself, just to tie it together. And because I know I've picked up anthologies before, of different subjects. And when you go from chapter to chapter, if the lettering's wildly different, it kind of takes you out of it a little bit. Even if the artwork is different, if you keep the lettering, you only notice the lettering if it's bad lettering.
If it's bad. Exactly. Yeah. That's exactly it. Lettering is so important. And, you know, a lot of writers think, oh, I'll just do lettering myself so I don't have to pay another person. But it's a whole different skill set. It's not just typing. Like, that's not it.
Right.
So yes, if you learn to letter and you do your own lettering, that's fabulous. So you scripted. Did you have everything completely scripted then?
Yeah.
'Cause this is a big, pretty big book.
I was last year I was just kind of hunkered down in my office and typing, and I'd have, you know, my research everywhere, and I'd be typing, and after I got a chapter of, 10 or 15 pages, I would do all the page templates and, you know, based on whatever, panel layout I had in the script, I'd make the panel layout, you know, be it a 6-panel grid or a 5-panel grid. That was just another one of the ways I could unify the art, throughout the book and keep it easy to follow. Just making really, basic comic panel layouts. It's kind of a throwback way to do it, sort of like an EC Comics way of doing it, in a sense that you make the panels and you put the lettering in there. That way the artist knows that's how much space the lettering needs. So nothing gets covered up. No artwork gets covered up because the lettering's already there. So
yeah, it's kind of brilliant. And I never heard of it before.
Yeah.
A lot of times that'll be a lettering complaint is, they have the characters on the wrong side. You know, you're supposed to read from, you know, right, from left to right. And, otherwise you get the balloons crossing and that's nonsense. Nobody wants to read that.
But yeah, any skilled cartoonist, if they see the lettering in one place, it kind of automatically dictates how the storytelling is going to be told throughout the page. So that was just one of my ways that I can control the storytelling without having to draw it myself. So after every chapter, I do all the panel layouts and the lettering, and just like the rough lettering. I wouldn't do the finished lettering. So I'd send them the rough grid and the lettering, and they'd send me back either the pencils or the finished inks, and I'd go in and do the finished lettering on top of that, and then the finished page would be after I completed it. So, that was process for every chapter, and I'd be doing, you know, several chapters at once, working with artists, depending on what the timeline was.
Okay. So you had to have like all, you know, 100 pages of script was totally done. You didn't do it chapter by chapter. Okay.
Yeah. I mean, I had a rough deadline, I think. Like the end of last year, I wanted to have it all done, but I think we went over that. Every artist had their own thing going on and they fit this in as best they could. And so I might be doing one aspect of one chapter and then doing art corrections on another chapter. And then one chapter I have to script and one chapter I have to, do a panel layout. So I'd be doing different things all the time, but the most labor intensive for me was just doing the scripting, because it's just draining and you're kind of immersed in the storytelling in your head. So getting to work on the actual pages was like a vacation to me.
There was so much that I learned, because like you said that you were a casual fan. That's all I really knew was, you know, the greatest hits of Willie Nelson and, and he did appear on Monk, which was, you know, one of my favorite shows.
He has his Hollywood career too.
Has his Hollywood career and Wag the Dog. I loved his role in Wag the Dog, which is a movie. You know, if you've never heard of it, please figure out how to watch it, because it seems to always be relevant. talking about politics. The songs that Willie wrote for other people, and yet the covers that he did of other people's songs, I really learned all kinds of stuff that, you know, these songs that I thought were so iconically Willie, you know, like Blue Eyes Crying in the Rain, and I didn't realize that he hadn't written that. But then, right. you know, he gets to, you really get to know who he was as a person, like this struggling guy who would just pick up and leave, go from town to town, packing up his family. He had several wives throughout his lifetime because it was not easy being married to a musician, I guess. And, you know, and he would just really grind at it, you know, and when he needed money, he would try to sell encyclopedias from door to door, whatever it took.
Yeah. Yeah. He did whatever it took. What's that?
I said, I think people in comics can probably relate.
Oh yeah. Yeah. It's a grind. But yeah, he would do whatever it took to get by. And, more often than not, it was his wife that would support him while he was trying to make it in some way in music. Whether it was as a songwriter or a performer, just, you know, going to club after club, playing several shows a night, or yeah, trying to sell his songs, or he would do side jobs like selling encyclopedias, or at a certain point he was a radio DJ.
And, yeah. So at least it was steady, and he could, slip in his own records once in a while.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. Plus he had access to recording equipment so he could record his own songs and maybe play them, you know, if he could. And he could plug his own gigs on the air, which is always helpful. I would think.
Yeah. Very helpful. Definitely. And, you know, and the fact that Willie Nelson, of all people, like, didn't feel fully welcome by the record labels, you know, like they couldn't figure out, you know, who he was, what kind of music is this? And yet when he got the opportunity to finally be like his authentic self, it, you know, it felt enlightening
you know,
for him. And he could finally like ditch the suits and let his hair grow, and he was smoking weed and you know, just hanging out with his other musician friends doing what they love.
He was for a long time there, he would do whatever it took to make it, and if that meant fitting into any kind of mold that a record executive would want to put him in, he would be willing to try it. And he's like, okay, if you think I can do that, I'll do that. And after doing that for several times, he's like, well, maybe I should do it differently. And for a while, he even retired and just became a farmer. And he was farming pigs on a farm. And but then, you know, he went to Austin and he saw this new thing happening with all the long hairs. and he started playing there. And
it was different than Nashville. It was just...
Yeah, much different than Nashville. And everybody was kind of doing their own thing. So, yeah, at that point, he could really be himself. And that's when he kind of blossomed and everybody took notice. In a mainstream way, at least.
Right. Yeah, definitely a difference. Like, you know, and you mentioned this, the Beatles, but, you know, same thing. You know, we saw how they started and then what it was like when counterculture, you know.
Yeah. Really, you can't imagine when you were a musician at that time, you can't help but be influenced by what's happening at that time. So,
yeah. And Willie was in the military and he hurt his back seriously. And, you know, so, for him to still be so, you know, like this peaceful kind of person and, very generous from the sound of it, you know, he helped orchestrate charity events and Farm Aid and things like that. And,
right.
Just always looking to help other musicians too. So.
Yeah. He's always been a generous soul. And, just generally a positive person, doesn't like to dwell on anything negative. I think he's kind of notorious for not attending funerals just because he doesn't want to dwell on anything negative. He doesn't like to think about the past, doesn't like to worry. He's just kind of a good influence in general, on me at least.
Yeah. And you didn't, I mean, nothing is sugarcoated in this story. That's what's, you know, it's very real. Like, you know, when he got flagged for, you know, not paying his taxes, because again, as a creative person, he entrusted somebody to do the bookkeeping and do be his business manager, and the person did not pay the taxes.
Right.
So, you know, that fell down on him, and he, you know, once again struggling. So like there's these cycles of him like being dirt poor over and over again.
Yeah, but he could always fall back on just going out on the road, and that was just that's always been his go-to ever since he was a kid. I mean, you can just, it's just like a stand-up comedian. You know, if they have a network series or something that gets canceled, they can always go back to stand-up because they know the road and they know they can make money. So it's like that. I mean, he can always sing for the money.
That's it. On the road again. All right. Well, so TJ, where can people get more information about you? And as we said, the Willie Nelson graphic history book is out through NBM. So you can find their website. But where can they find about you in particular?
They can find more about me at tjkirsch.com. And like you said, they can always go to the NBM website, and that's nbmpub.com, and they can find more out about Pride of the Decent Man, as well as Willie Nelson, A Graphic History, and on Twitter at TJ Kirsch, and on Instagram at TJ Kirsch 81, because that's when I was born, 1981.
Well, thank you so much for the history lessons and just sharing this bit of your life. It's great to, you know, to talk to you besides on Twitter.
You too. Yeah, this has been great. It's been my pleasure.
So what was your literary agent page again?
Oh, it was site. I'm on Twitter at JCH Literary, and on the web at jchliterary.com. And there they can see any kind of submission guidelines if there's a comic creator that wants to reach out, or a picture book author or anything like that. All of my submission guidelines are on that page.
Okay, fantastic. And you guys can keep following along with the cat adventures that get posted daily at Instagram at Amber Unmasked. But to get the weekly case files that get written up often with hilarious GIFs when possible, as often as possible. sometimes there might be a whole like Schitt's Creek themed case file, even though it has nothing to do with Schitt's Creek. that is at Amber Unmasked, and you can support my work at patreon.com/AmberUnmasked. So TJ, thanks again for your time and the effort and the Willie Nelson history.
Thank you so much. And I'm glad you read the book, and I'm glad you enjoyed it.